that's a good-looking crowd. So, Greg, I'm just going to tell you that I'm timing, so you don't have to tell me to done, okay? First of all, I want to thank the committee for having me here and for Ashley for being such a wonderful host. I really appreciated the time we got to spend, and she was so flexible with me. She said, oh, we would love, I would love to go to dinner with you, and I was like, I am exhausted, so can I just take a nap? And she was so gracious and wonderful, so I just absolutely love it. And when I saw Kay, I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm home. And Maddie, oh, so good to see you all. So my first meeting of Al-Anon was February 4th, 2008, and if you're calculating, yes, just last weekend, it was 16 years since I've been in Al-Anon. That just shows me that I've known that I'm crazy for 16 years. Right? I'm going to tell you a little bit about how it was, you know, and what happened that brought me to Al-Anon, and tell you a lot more about what it's like today. I was born an only child, and I had, you know, brilliant parents. My father was just an amazing mathematician, and my mother was so creative, and my father was an alcoholic. He never drank in front of me, so I never thought that he was an alcoholic, but because he didn't drink, he was a rager. And my mother grew up with two brothers who were alcoholics. Her mother grew up with two brothers that were alcoholic, and one of them died alcoholically. So this runs for generations. So for generations, the women have been teaching the next generation how to do for other people what they can do for themselves, how to, you know, how to compensate for them, how to like protect them from, you know, consequences of their actions and all that kind of stuff. And my mom did the best she could, right? And she didn't know any better. Growing up as a girl in India was a little bit challenging. I went to an all-girls like campus, so I wasn't aware of that as much. But whenever I went back to like my, you know, visit my parents' siblings or my grandparents and stuff like that, it was very clear to me that I was different. I had to strive extra to be good enough. My dad was very clear that being a girl in India was going to really struggle if I wasn't the best of the best. So he demanded the best of the best. I remember in 12th grade, I came back home from my math exam and I told him that I had messed up on one question. And so I was going to score a 92. Well, see, 90 was an A, right? My father didn't just say, oh, great, but you must have made an A, so that's good. No, he said, what happened to the 8 points? Do you know, y'all, for 17 years, he did not forget that I messed up that one question, and he would remind me about the question that I messed up. So I always know what a binomial distribution looks like. My dad's rage was unpredictable. You know, one moment I'd be sitting in his lap and everything was okay, and then the next moment, you know, something would happen. He never got mad at me, but he got mad at mom a lot. And he would get mad, he would just fly off into this rage, and his soft hands would seem like they were just like burning. I didn't want to be around there, but I would be sitting in his lap and very uncomfortable. So it was a very tenuous kind of a marriage for my parents. And you know, come to think of it, it was a tenuous kind of a marriage for my uncles and my grandparents and everybody pretty much. So up and down being affected by alcoholism. So I grew up thinking that I wasn't good enough, just because I was never good enough for dad. So I went to the top engineering college. I got all kinds of honors and, you know, medals and all that kind of stuff. It didn't touch me because it was always the next thing, whatever was the next thing. There was a lot of, you know, drinking and drugs in the campus and stuff like that, and I didn't participate in any of them because I had to have all of my faculties because as such I wasn't good enough, you know, I had to be on guard. It was right when I was like two months before I went to college, our family life fell apart. My mom had put up with my dad for so long. It had been like 19 years. And she said, okay, now that she's going off to college, I'm gonna go do my thing. And she decided to renounce everything and become an Indian, like nun, you know, those people who wear orange clothes and leave everything. And she changed her name and, you know, went to live in an ashram, which is like a monastery. And my mom had been my rock. I mean, I grew up with my mom. My dad was, you know, elsewhere for predominantly all of that, my childhood. And he would come like twice a year, and it was kind of miserable when dad would come, but mom was always there. Like when I wanted to know what safety was, what security was, what, you know, if I had any questions, mom was always there. And when I was 17, mom was like, I'm done. I'm out of here. And she told me at first was like, you know, I'm gonna go do my thing. And I thought I was gonna be a part of it, right? Like I was gonna be able to go visit her where she is. It was fine, mom and dad were not happy. But no, she said she needed to cut off all ties with everybody, including me. And I thought, oh my gosh, what am I gonna do? And so I started looking at my dad like, okay, finally he's gonna show up as the parent. I was in the first semester of college, and dad said to come to New Delhi because he was finishing up the divorce proceedings. And I was like, why are you divorcing? You know, mom has left, you and I are it. Well, I went for the divorce proceedings as a witness because I had heard from my mom since then and she was not coming back. And right after the divorce was granted, when he put me on a bus to go back to the campus, as the bus was moving, he said, you don't mind if I remarry, do you? Bottom fell out, y'all. I did not expect that at all. Because here I am, an only child. My mom left, and I thought dad was gonna be it. I'm going to this place that I don't know, and you know, I'm all by myself. I lived with my parents until then, and I was in a dorm by myself, didn't know anybody, and now my dad was gone. So I mumbled something and told him, yeah, I was okay. But then all of that bus ride back to campus, I was bawling. I was crying and, you know, I was really upset. I was, you know, first of all, for the first like 4 hours, I was like, oh, poor me. This, you know, this is happening to me and I'm gonna be all alone. And the last half hour of it, I got mad. Not at mom or dad or me. Mm-mm. I got mad at God. Because see, I didn't have a very good concept of God. See, my concept of God, in spite of all these 30,000 gods and goddesses that I grew up around, right? My concept of God was there was this statue in a temple. You go there and, you know, every so often you go there and you pray to them and then ask for things and they give it to you, and in return you give some kind of like offering. Right? It was a bargain. It was a barter. So I didn't understand. I didn't know what I had not offered and why God was being this way, but I got mad at God. I was like, fine, it doesn't look like you are showing up for me, so I got this. You know what? You can go take care of all the other people who cry and complain. That was my idea of prayer. Cry and complain. I got this. You never have to worry about it now. And so that's how I pretty much lived from then on. I was like, I'm the only one that's gonna be there for me. So can you hear Soulful Run Riot? So I fell in love in college, and he was an angry young man, but he was not angry at me. He got angry at the system. He would like, you know, get angry at like, you know, how long things take, and he would take off his watch and throw it to the ground, and it was like it would shatter, and I was like, oh my God, I'm in love. Later, I realized I was in love with the idea of being in love, with the idea that I had a boyfriend. We decided to, that we were, you know, we were it, and we were gonna get married, and so he wanted to come to the US more than he wanted to breathe. Always, it's America this and America that. And I was like, I had no plans of leaving India. Because I mean, that's where I had grown up. I mean, y'all know, you know, you don't move very far away from where you grew up. And so I had no plans of coming to America. And And he would just be like, America this, and if we were here in America at this time, we would be able to do blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, oh my God. So we wanted to do the romantic thing of like both of us study, take our GREs and like come to America as students and like do this either long distance, like you are at this university, I'm at that university, and we visit each other and then afterwards we get married. That was gonna be our thing. So we studied. I did really well in the GREs, and I did really well, and I got my admission in college and with scholarship, and without scholarship we couldn't have made it. And he didn't get any scholarships, and so I came to America, and he didn't. That was not the plan. That was not the plan. University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and you know, I've got this thick Indian accent. I don't know what I'm doing. And I was a teaching assistant, and I remember I would teach algebra. Algebra and calculus, that was the thing I was teaching. And I had a thick Indian accent, and I had people like dropping my class like flies. Okay, I gotta work on my accent. This is not cool. So anyway, that's how the accent, and I couldn't afford it, so I listened to people, how they kept their mouth, how they pronounced things, and I would go home and I would practice, like, you know, at like 11 o'clock at night in front of a mirror, I'd be like, cow. Because, you know, I mean, I grew up saying cow. Anyway, I was so miserable without him that after two semesters I went back, got married, brought him back. Because, you know, it was my job to pave the way for what was going to happen for him, you know? He wanted this more than anything, and it was my job to be the medium to do this. Yeah, love is blind. So, literally, it was like 6 months to the day that he came. I was like, oh my God, I have made the biggest mistake of my life. We were not compatible. He's a good man. We were not compatible. You know, it's just we never should have been married. Anyway, so it took about 6 years or so. I left him and moved to Texas, actually Dallas-Fort Worth, for a job. But before that, I tried the usual typical thing of like you want to have a baby, right, to fix the marriage. I tried. Four fertility doctors later, they told me that, you know, it was going to be a problem. I had some kind of a complication, and it was going to be a problem to conceive. So I was like, okay, there goes that. You know, we separated. So there had been, you know, a lot of mental abuse and verbal abuse, but also there was a physical abuse situation. And so I knew that I wasn't going to go back. But I was really closed up when I came to Dallas, and I found out about a self-improvement workshop. I didn't know anything about Al-Anon. I didn't know I was affected by alcoholism. Didn't know any of that. I was like, I don't know why, but I'm just this really miserable person. And so I went to the self-improvement workshop, and it helped me a lot with putting my past in the past. And I was able to forgive my dad. And that was big, because I married somebody just like my dad. Right? And so I didn't want to make that mistake again. I wanted to fix my picker, so I picked better. So I went, made my peace with my dad and I talked through a lot of things. I went back to India and we talked through a lot of things, and, you know, we took a daddy-daughter trip to the Taj Mahal, which we would have never done ever, because I wouldn't want to spend that elongated time with dad. I'm so glad I did that. Because in 2003, I had just moved from Texas to Charlotte, North Carolina, and I got a phone call one day that my dad had died in a train accident. And we never had anything, we didn't have anything left to say. He knew I loved him, I knew he loved me, and we were friends, and I was his biggest confidant. And he knew that there was one person that was there for him in this world, that was me. And I was grateful to have had that kind of relationship with my dad after the kind of tumultuous thing that I had when growing up. So at that self-improvement workshop, I met this shy guy who was standing off in a corner. And of course, if he was standing off in a corner, I had to go fix it. So went over and I'm like, hey, what's your name? And he said his name was Gary. And I was like, and he wasn't talking much. And I was like, oh, what did you get out of this workshop? It was so cool. And we kept crossing paths, you know, back and forth and stuff like that. And so in March of 1998, a mutual friend set us up for a date. And we went out, and the rest is history. I've been with Gary now. This March is going to be 26 years, something like that. So I think it was like the second date that he told me that he was an alcoholic and he had gone to AA for 5 years. And then he had not gone to AA for 5 years. And at the dinner that we had at, I don't know how many of y'all remember Spaghetti Warehouse, that was our first date. So we were sitting at Spaghetti Warehouse in I think it was Northwest Ridgeland Hills in Dallas, Fort Worth. And we were sitting, across from each other, and, you know, he was having a glass of wine, and I was having a glass of wine, and we were staring into each other's eyes and being in love. He didn't reach over and drink my wine, y'all. I thought he was fixed. I thought AA has fixed him. Did not know about this whole, like, you know, abstinence thing. I didn't know any of that, like, you know. So I thought he was fixed and didn't think anything about it. I was like, okay, well, apparently you can drink now in moderation. So we moved fast. So we got together March 22nd, and then by April 1st, I think, he had moved in. I think it was April 30th, I found out that I was pregnant. I was on birth control pills. So, yeah. So, I had this miracle baby at this point now. It was an interesting adjustment because, you know, we didn't have like a lot of time to just couple, be romantic. We were pregnant. We had a baby, you know, coming up. And so, it was December of 1998, and my baby was this beautiful little baby girl. And, big brown eyes, and I always talk about the skin. The baby girl had the skin that was a combination of the two of us. So she had, you know, she like would tan but not really burn. And it's this flawless skin that doesn't age. And I'm like, oh my God, this is a gorgeous little baby. And she would just tear up. You know, he was really lonely, and so his drinking worsened. So it got to the point of like a liter and a half of wine every day kind of thing. And I was like, I was more upset about how much he was spending on alcohol, frankly. But then also we would go to parties and he would like embarrass me. He would, you know, he would, first of all, he drank red wine. So he would have this weird like stain in his mouth and I was just like, ew. And then he would stand and he would sway and he would say the same thing for the 15th time and he would just embarrass the heck out of me. You know, and he would, of course, insist on driving after he had had all this wine with our child in the back. And did I just, like, be quiet so that we could just get home as soon as possible? Oh, no, no, no. Every time the tire went over the yellow line or the white line, I would tell him about it. Because, you know, it's like he needed to know that he was drunk, and I knew that. So, poor kid. You know, growing up in that kind of a chaos is tough. I got mad, I kicked doors, and, you know, I would yell and scream, and everybody at home was scared of me. In 2007, back up, in 2005, I got my citizenship, and in 2005, my mom also had a very scary incident in India when she almost died because of breathing allergies that she had. And so I asked my mom to come, you know, live with us because air in America, I swear, is so much more cleaner and so much better. And so I was like, Mom, why don't you come live with us? So Mom moved in 2007. And you know what I didn't realize is I had so many unresolved issues with Mom. I felt abandoned by her and all of that. So I was angry. I was just a ball of anger. Just, you know, I would walk and I think I exuded anger. And so in 2008, my mom comes to me in January, and she said, so you know, Gary loves you a lot. I said, yeah, and Gary's a good father. I was like, yeah, what are you trying to say? Well, she was building up to that Gary went to the ABC store to get hard liquor because, you know, and took the kid with him and said, don't tell Mom. And see, we had, you know, we were homeschooling at the time. We were like, we wanted to bring up the child, you know, knowing that these are the values and we have to tell each other what's going on. We have to be able to be honest with each other. And so, you know, I for once I didn't yell and scream and kick doors. I just went up to him and I felt completely defeated. And I went up to him and I said, look, I don't know what's going on. My mom just told me that you did this and you told our child to lie. And you know that's not something we agreed to as parents. I don't know, but I think alcohol controls you. And I don't know what to do. Can you go back to your friends in AA who might be able to help you? And then I left, you know, and I was like, I just can't live like this. And then I walked away. He went to AA, I think it was either that night or the next night he went to AA, and he said he felt like he had come home. You know, he went to AA and he felt at home. And that's what he had been missing for so long. And as of January 31st, he had 16 years in AA. So I was like, great, this is gonna do it. This is fixing everything. The big nasty alcoholic has gone to AA. We're all gonna be happy. Life is gonna be all sunshine and roses. Yeah, no, the next day I'm coming home from work and you know, there's no lights on. I mean, there's lights on in my mom's room and you know, I knew our daughter was playing with my mom, but there was no lights on and I'm like, where'd he go? I mean, his vehicle's there. Turns out he was sitting in the living room staring at a television that wasn't on and he was just miserable. Oh my gosh, you know how you can like read energy from a person, like you go there and you're like, whoa, there's a cloud of energy around you? He had this like total, pardon my French, pissed off energy. Like he was so mad, he was so upset, he was angry and seething and I was like, oh my gosh, AA was supposed to make him a happy alcoholic. And so it didn't. So I avoided him. I just like, you know, I thought to myself, I'm like, okay, what am I supposed to do? And I was like, I'm just gonna steer clear. I went to the back, talked to my mom, talked to my daughter, had a great time, went to bed. The next day, same thing. And now I have this like pattern, right? So now my brain starts acting. The moment I open the door, I know he's sitting there and, you know, in a dark room, and I'm like, okay, what am I supposed to do? Should I talk to him? Maybe I should talk to him. Maybe I should ask him how AA is going, or maybe he's gonna get really mad about AA because I sent him there. So, you know, that's gonna be bad. So maybe I should tell him about my day, because corporate America is full of all kinds of drama. And so it would be great, it would distract him. Or maybe he's gonna say, all you care about is your day and your corporate America situation and drama. You don't care about me. Maybe I should ask him what's for dinner. Maybe he would get upset because all I care about is dinner and not care about him. Maybe I should just, oh, you know what I should do? I should bring our daughter, and she's very ticklish. So I should bring our daughter, I should tickle her. She will laugh, he will laugh, I will laugh, we'll all laugh, and he'll forget about his anger. Every single thought, y'all, every single thought was, what was I going to do to change someone because I was uncomfortable with how they were being? Right, every single thought, and I was obsessing over the same thing over and over and over, even while I was with my daughter, while I was getting ready to go to bed. And I was like, this is gonna go crazy, this is gonna be crazy, I can't do this. I mean, if this is how, and I knew that AA was like, you know, at that point he had told me that it's a lifelong program, you're gonna be there, going there all the time, and I was like, this is gonna be untenable, right, intolerable, this is not gonna work. So the third day, I called my friend who had been in AA for a dozen years, and I said, what did you say was a program for families and friends of alcoholics? And she said, Al-Anon. And I said, okay, so that sounds like just like Alcoholics Anonymous, just shorter. And then I was like, okay, can you tell me a little bit about it? She goes, look, I don't know as much about it, but I'm going to ask this person to call you. And so this woman called me on a Sunday afternoon, and I found myself pouring my heart out to her and saying, you know, talking about what it was like and talking about how I didn't feel comfortable in the house and I was so angry and I didn't know why he was being how he was being and I just couldn't be with it. And she said, you know, it would be great for you to come to an Al-Anon meeting, and there's a great Al-Anon meeting on Monday night. It's Queen City Monday night. And so it was, so my husband got sober at the end of January. I went to the first Queen City Monday night meeting in February. That's how I know February 4th, 2008. Normally a lot of people are like, well, I came in February. Maybe I came in 2008, 2009. No, I knew exactly which day I came. So I go there and I went to this Queen City Al-Anon meeting, and I went way back. I was like way in the back. It was a speaker meeting. And my dear friend, who's here in the audience, was speaking. And I was like, I don't know these people. I don't know what this program is, but whatever. So I went in the back, and she's talking about the, you know, the things that happened, like how it was before things happened, and how, you know, she's handling life that, you know, now that she's in Al-Anon and her husband's in AA and all that kind of stuff. And I was like, I'm sitting there going, good for you. Your life sucks. You need to keep coming back. I don't have a tenth of the things that you're talking about. I don't have any of this stuff going on. So I don't know, maybe I don't need to be here. Maybe I'm not miserable enough, so maybe I shouldn't. But you know, what's interesting is I was told at the end to keep coming back. And you know, I've never admitted defeat at the first time. And I was like, fine, I'll keep coming back. But I'll come back, my condition. If I don't get value from one Al-Anon meeting, I'm never coming back. Okay. 16 years later, I keep coming back. So the first few meetings, they were talking about, the first thing they were talking about, the three C's. I didn't cause it, I can't cure it, I can't control it. And I applied it to work. Like my boss was an angry person. Of course I'd have an angry boss, right? Why not? Just like my dad. So my boss was an angry person, and I remember there was, you know, he would always, like, I would say something and he would react and I would shut down and the meeting would always go south from there. This time what happened was he got a phone call I ran to the restroom. I sat in the restroom and I was like, I didn't cause his anger. I can't control his anger. I can't cure his anger. You know, and I'm all I can do is contribute to it, and I'm not going to contribute to it. So it's not about me, right? And then I came back, he finished his call, and we had a great meeting. I was like, holy cow, this stuff doesn't just work on alcoholics. It works on the bosses. That is ridiculous. Oh my gosh. So I was like, fine, I got value out of it. I'm going to go back to one more Al-Anon meeting. And then they told me about detachment with love, and I thought they were talking about the big D, divorce. And I was like, no, I've already been there, done that. The thing I know is the common denominator would be me. And so I'm not going to be that common denominator, thank you very much, because that would really reinforce that was not good enough. And so I was like, okay, what does detachment with love mean? And so the person that was talking there, I just love the recovery in Charlotte. It's amazing. And the person that was talking there said, you know, the way I think about detachment with love is if this person wasn't here doing what they were doing or not doing what they were not doing, what would I do and go do that? So I come home, it's dark, and he's sitting in the dark room and staring, you know, out in space or television that isn't on or whatever. And I'm like, okay, so if he wasn't sitting here doing what he's doing, what would I do? And I was like, well, I would go to the back, I would change clothes, I would go say hello to my mom, play with my daughter a little bit, fix something to eat, go hang out with them. I mean, we didn't watch much TV. We're not TV watchers. So I would go back and hang out with them. And so I did that. And you know what? For moments, the chatter stopped. That constant, you know, hamster wheel, it stopped. And I was like, whoa, is that serenity? Is that what it feels like to have, like, no thought? No constant chatter? Oh my gosh, I want some of this. And so I kept coming back. So I worked with a sponsor who wanted me to, you know, to read the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous and, you know, to understand the alcoholic and everything, but also just read it. And I was like, I'm sorry, I can't. She said, why? I said, it's in Times New Roman. Okay, y'all, I hate Times New Roman. Do you know, somebody would send me resume in Times New Roman. I don't know why people think that that's like the more formal resume font. I'm just telling you, Times New Roman sucks. So I would highlight the whole resume. I will change it to Arial, and then I can read it. As long as it's Times New Roman, kid you not. If you receive any document from me, it will never be in Times New Roman, just so you know. I called my sponsor and I'm like, it's in Times New Roman, I can't read it. And she's like, what? So she asked me to buy the One Day at a Time in Al-Anon ODAT, and do you know what? It was in Times New Roman. Courage to Change is in Times New Roman. So when our new book came out, the latest one, I was sitting at the same table at the International Convention with Tom Coffey, our Associate Director of Literature at WSO, and I looked at him and I said, Arial, oh my God, Arial. There was nobody happier about the font choice from WSO this time. I'm just telling you. I finally belonged in Al-Anon. People were not pushing Times New Roman down my throat. Hey, you know what? We all have our own obsessions. This is mine. So, you know, I worked my steps. I could see that I was powerless over whether Gary was going to stay sober. I was really worried that my daughter was going to end up being an alcoholic, because I heard that there's a higher chance, if one parent is an alcoholic, that she would. And I was like, oh my God, what's gonna happen? Oh my God, what if she turns out to be an alcoholic? And at that time, everybody would say, well, at least she would know about the programs. And I'm like, yeah, that's very nice for you to say. You know, it's my daughter that will be an alcoholic. And so anyway, sometime through my journey in Al-Anon, that obsession went away. I guess it's as I defined my higher power in step two, that's where it started to go away, because the higher power, I didn't have an understanding of a higher power. So I would say the higher power of my misunderstanding just did not work. So in step two, I love that I got to define my higher power. I got to define that my God talks to me in nature. And I say God because I don't associate any religion with God. I just associate just this power that is always there, that's benevolent, and that is loving and kind and accepting and just ever present. So my God talks to me in nature. And so I was able to do that, and I was able to just be quiet wherever I am, and I could close my eyes and I could really visualize being in nature and being in the middle of trees and birds chirping, and my God talks to me there, and that's perfectly fine. And I could be anywhere in the middle of an airport and that can be fine. So in step three, my sponsor asked me to write about all the time in my life where no human power could have saved me. And that was a weird thing, but I was told to do what my sponsor asked me to do, so I did. My mom was like this archive. My mom had this amazing memory. So my mom was telling me about this one incident where I was 2 years old, and we were standing in a busy street corner in New Delhi, and my dad was off buying something, and my mom was looking, you know, around to where we were supposed to go. I got tired. I sat down at the curb, right at the edge of the curb, and something said to my mom to yank me away from the corner. She reached over. She didn't question it. She turned around, reached over, yanked me away from the corner. And I didn't know what was going on. I was just like, okay, whatever. The next second, a bus went over, jumped the curb, went over exactly where I was sitting. And you know, that incident when my mom told me was really the pivotal point where I was like, oh my gosh, there is some power out there that my mom, who I thought like would be watching for me all the time, my mom was not looking out for me. And my dad was not there. And something said to my mom to yank me away from the corner, that something wants me alive, that something wants me to be there. So I don't get scared, I don't get nervous. And you know, I was on the plane and I was sitting next to this guy this time coming from Charlotte to Dallas. And this guy was so scared flying. I think it had been a year since he flew. And I told him, I said, look, I am sleep deprived and I've been flying since I was 2 years old. So I'm gonna sleep hard even before the plane takes off. But if you're nervous, just, you know, feel free to grab my arm, because he's like a young guy, you know. And I was like, feel free to grab my arm like I'm like his mom. And if you need to go to the bathroom or something like that, shake me hard, because I'm sleeping. I'm going to sleep through soundly. And see, that's how I'm able to go through life, is that, you know, I don't need to worry about my welfare, whether I'm going to be alive, if the plane is going to be, you know, able to, you know, if the plane is going to be able to land safely, if I'm going to die, none of that. I don't worry about that. And that is an amazing gift. That's an amazing gift, with having that relationship with my higher power. Because if I do, you know, if I do pass, what I would do is go from this hand of the higher power to this hand of the higher power. Right? There's nothing to be afraid of. So fear going away after that relationship with God was just an unbelievable gift of this program for me. In step four, I was able to see everything that I had done to my child, to my mom, and everything. And I was so mortified at how I had acted. That was not how I wanted to love my only child, you know? And so, it was an amazing awakening. And I thought in step five, my sponsor was going to judge me. She got up at one point to go, and I was like, okay, she's probably going to go there and call her sponsor or friend and say, oh my God, do you know this woman is crazy, and I have her in my home? She's doing her fit step. No, she went to get a nicotine gum. She was trying to quit smoking. No drama, really. In step seven, loved that step seven provided me an understanding of being one of many. You know, that I grew up with not belonging. I grew up with not feeling like I fit in. I grew up with trying to look at everybody as a competition. You know, because I had to be better than the girls, I had to be better than the boys, because I had to be able to survive in this world because I wasn't safe. And step seven provided me the ability to just feel at home wherever I am. People didn't have to look a certain way, they didn't have to act a certain way, just knowing that I'm a part of this giant sea of humanity. It's amazing. It's amazing because then I'm never alone. I'm never lonely. You know, I'm amongst God's children. And for me, that was a huge gift because I had never felt comfortable in my own skin. You know, growing up, I didn't feel comfortable in my own skin. I had to be different. I had to act differently. I had to, you know, perform differently. I had to be whatever, you know, I had to achieve differently. And right now, I belong. At this moment, I am one of you. And I love that. Just having that feeling of belonging is just amazing. And that's a gift of Al-Anon. In step nine, I made amends to my daughter, and she was so forgiving. She was like, oh, it's okay, mommy. I was telling her that mommy's gonna work hard never to do this again. I'm gonna do my best. And, you know, if I do make a mistake, I will make sure that I apologize and figure out why. And, you know, this is what was happening with mommy. And she was like, okay, mommy, that's fine. Little did I know, I was creating a monster who's gonna hold me to my program. And whenever I messed up, my program buddy was gonna call me out on it. So I finished my steps. It took me, when I came into the program, I was like this Miss Overachiever, you know, Dr. Miss Overachiever here. I was like, I'm gonna finish the program 1 week a step, 12 weeks, I'm gonna graduate Al-Anon. It took me 12 months, okay, it was not bad. 12 months to do my 12 steps, that's okay. And I was still gonna divorce Gary because, you know, it was, you know, my life supposedly was going fine until he showed up with his alcoholism, you know, in my face. And in North Carolina, well, see, the first time I had divorced, I was in Texas. So in Texas, you don't have to wait for a divorce, right? So I knew that stuff. But in North Carolina, you got to wait and be separated for a year. And I was like, crap, okay. So anyway, there was a tradition study going on and that was gonna go for a few months. And I thought, well, if I'm gonna like try to figure out being separated for a year and do all of that, might as well, you know, do whatever I need to do to fix my picker so the third time I pick somebody is not gonna be bad. So the tradition study was going on, and as they were talking about how to apply traditions as they apply in relationships. And I thought traditions were these boring things that were read in the, you know, in the meetings. And I was like, what's up with applying them to relationships? The first meeting I went, and I was, you know, I'm just like furious note taker, right? So I'm taking notes and they're talking about these things and I'm going, whoa, it blew my mind. And I knew exactly where I needed to be, and that was in that tradition study. And in the first tradition, they were talking about what is my family's primary purpose. I'd never thought about my family's primary purpose. I thought it was to make me look good. But really what came was this thing that I had read in that Times New Roman big book about growing along spiritual lines. And I was like, okay, so if we are put together to grow along spiritual lines, that completely changes the focus of how I expect things from my husband, how I expect things from my daughter, how I expect things from my mom. Because you know what? We are on different paths that are growing along spiritual lines. I can't expect my husband to practice the steps just like I do. I can't expect, you know, my daughter to be a certain way. We are all growing along spiritual lines. And I was like, wow. So we don't have to have one person, you know, call the shots, or we don't have to look a certain way or act a certain way as a family. That gave me so much freedom. It was like oxygen. Tradition two, there's but one authority, a loving God. Wait a minute. A loving God? I was the queen of the house. I was the breadwinner. My husband stayed home. We homeschooled our child. So I was the breadwinner. Hello. I was the one who made rules in the house. I mean, what I said goes, and my husband would never question it. We were kind of a sick family. But apparently, he and I were both trusted servants. Wait a minute, what? How come he was a trusted servant? I used to always check up on him, make sure that he did the thing that he took on, and he was always late. And so I would then say, well, look, see, you didn't do it on time. And apparently that was not my job. And I came to Al-Anon, and I was looking at some of the GRs, and I was like, oh my God, this GR sucks. And then, but you know what? Y'all just respected the group representative, and y'all said, thank you for your service. And I'm like, wait a minute. Everybody is gracious and kind. Not the way it was in my household, right? And I was like, oh my gosh, that's how I'm supposed to treat my husband? And so it was, I no longer wanted to divorce him. Tradition to put a kibosh on that. So it was very amazing to see that there was a loving God that was there, which meant that I got to ask my husband's opinion about something. So I'll tell you, most recently, like 2.5 weeks ago, we got a puppy. And I wanted a puppy for my other dog, who was an apple of my eye. And so I wanted a puppy to give her company. And I know how much trouble puppies are. And so I was talking to my husband about it, and I said, you know, I think we should get a puppy. And I talked to the breeder, she's got a puppy, blah, blah, blah. And my husband's like, no, we don't need that. And I said, okay, we don't need a puppy, but it would be nice to have one. And he's like, no, we're too old for this. And I said, well, you know, if we wait until she dies, we'd be even older, you know. And so he's, you know, that was logical, you know. But anyway, we went back and forth, and he's like, I'm not ready to talk about it. Okay, great, I'll let it go the next day. I'm talking to him, and he's not happy about it. You know, it took me about 3 days, and I finally went, I get it. I heard you. We're not going to get a puppy. It's fine. I heard you. You're not ready for it. And he says, well, we have a puppy. But you know, it was until I really got where he was coming from, until I completely got his communication and accepted it without any objections, any, you know, yeah buts and whatnots and all that kind of stuff, that he was able to then think about, okay, maybe there might be a benefit. Because until then, I am hitting against the brick wall, right, until I hear him. And that's a gift of Al-Anon. That's a gift of traditions. He's a trusted servant. Because you know what, at 1 o'clock in the morning when I'm trying to sleep and he's trying to take the puppy out and, you know, to go potty, well, he's a trusted servant. And he's gonna have to do that. And so, and right now I'm here. Guess who's watching the puppy, right? So it gave me a really big appreciation for what a partner he is. He doesn't have to look like me, he doesn't have to act like me. God knows he doesn't need to act like me. But, you know, he is who he is, and both of us together make a unit. And we are trusted servants, and God is the ultimate authority. Tradition three, we are gathered together for mutual aid. Not for me to look good. We're gathered together for mutual aid to grow along spiritual lines. How can I help him grow along spiritual lines? How can I help my child grow along spiritual lines? And that's what we were there. And, you know, what I realized is that in Al-Anon, we are gathered together for mutual aid, and we share our experience, strength, and hope. I was not sharing my experience, strength, and hope at home. I was sharing my sickness at home. And so how can I share my experience, strength, and hope at home? And so that opened my eyes to, during that discussion, that opened my eyes to treating my family as fellow Al-Anon members. You know, I would not walk up to a fellow Al-Anon member and say, you gonna wear that? Really? Or, what possessed you to do that to your hair? Right? So, that completely put a filter on it. You know, I started getting quieter This is so weird. It's like the more I stayed in Al-Anon, the more I was quieter about my opinions. Because if I wouldn't say that to a fellow Al-Anon member, what gives me the right to say that to my family? And our family started to heal. And our family started to see the difference. By the way, I didn't say this, but my daughter, like 2 weeks after I had been in Al-Anon, I dragged her to Alateen, and she went through Alateen, and it was awesome because we had recovery of AA Al-Anon and Alateen in the household. Oh my God, that is such a gift. Such a gift. Oh my gosh. Tradition 4 talks about autonomy. I looked it up. It was autonomy is, you know, basically it's like people having boundaries, like nations having boundaries, you know, where something ends and where something begins. I didn't grow up having boundaries. I didn't know what boundaries were. Growing up, my mom and I were just like a thing, you know. So my daughter and I did not have boundaries, and I never honored her boundaries. And this challenged me to look at what are my boundaries and allow for God to work in my life. And also Tradition 4 talks about how does it affect Al-Anon as a whole or another group. And so how does my decision work for other people in my household? Hence the puppy decision, right? How does my decision affect other people in the household? And look at the effect of that. I didn't do that, y'all. My family just had to follow along before. You know, I'd make decisions and they just had to kind of deal with it. My husband had been dealing with it for a long time. Tradition 5 talks about practicing the 12 steps myself and then encourage and understand the alcoholic relative. See, I think it was 2016, I found out my husband had taken on a lot of debt and without my knowledge. And we came to almost not being together, because I was like, oh my God, I'm gonna leave you. This is amazing. This is unbelievable. I can't believe you would do this to our household. Did you not think about us being a family unit? All that kind of stuff. But what I was able to see is to encourage and understand the alcoholic relative did not say to pay for them what they were supposed to be taking care of, right? To take care of the consequences of their action was not what the Tradition 5 says. It says encourage, and it says understand. I understand that with his alcoholism comes a lot of little isms that has him do things without knowing where the limits are, right? And so I understand that. And when it was time for him to apply for jobs, I helped him with his resumes. Oh God, first there were times in New Roman to get me started. But I helped him with his resume, right? And you know, when he would come home and he was, you know, not happy with his first job, I got to talk to him and, you know, talk to him and help him feel what, you know, like, is this something that's something that you can deal with, or is this something that you need to quit? What do you need to do? I was there. I provided an opening for him to come and talk to me. And I didn't need to fix it for him. So he worked for 5.5 years and paid off his debts. And he did it. And you know, he had the feeling of having accomplished that. Yeah, my job was to watch my attitude, which was not a very good attitude, but still, it was better than it would have been before I was in Al-Anon. Tradition 6 really has me look at my motives and desires. You know, what am I trying to drive at? What is underlying all of this that I'm trying to say? Because y'all, communication comes so easily to me. Communication is a gift that God has given. Unfortunately, what comes with that is also manipulation, right? So who has to tell on my manipulation? I do, right? So this is an opportunity for me to look at my motives and my desires and tell one on myself and say, really, I am trying to manipulate this, and I'm not going to do that. That's not who I know myself to be. And that's not who higher power made me to be. Tradition 7 says we are self-supporting, declining outside contributions. I was like, got that. I am the breadwinner. Of course I am self-supporting when it comes to money. Because, you know, we would always, at least I don't know about y'all, but I would always only hear about self-supporting in the meetings in terms of, like, baskets going around. So I was like, don't need to think about it, I'm good, you know. But here's the thing. I constantly needed my husband to tell me I was okay. I constantly needed to bring my drama to him so that he could help resolve it. And I constantly needed for people at work to tell me that I was the best. What is that? Outside contributions? Uh-huh. So there's a lot of depth in these traditions, and it's just amazing that, you know, we have these tools that are right at our fingertips, that are available and that are read at every meeting, and there's so much depth in there. So tradition 8 says that I'm not in charge. Golly, I need so many reminders. Tradition 8, I need tradition 9, everything. You're not the queen. There's not a hierarchy. You're not at the top of the food chain. I need so many reminders. Tradition 10 is my favorite. We basically have no opinion on outside issues. So, my daughter was 14, and she came to me, 15, she came to me and she said, Mom, I have never identified as a girl. I don't feel like I fit in a girl body. And I want to transition, and I want to change my name. I want to go on hormones, and I want to be a boy. I want you to call me, you know, Alexander, and I want you to, you know, refer to me as he and him. And you know, tradition 10 says, we have no opinions on outside issues. Oh my God, this is like the gut-wrenching outside issue. Gut-wrenching. But you know what? My child's gender identity is outside of my hula hoop. I don't have to like it. I don't have to have an opinion on it because it's outside issue. So I had to weigh, on one side was my dream. I had dreams of this child. I had dreams that she would go to prom and I would buy her this beautiful red dress that would look so good with her skin. And I would help her shop for her wedding dress. And I would be in the hospital room when she gave birth to my grandchild. And on the other side is the love that I have for my child. You see, if my child happened to be on the road not looking and there was a car coming and was about to hit my child, I would never question, is this a girl or a boy? Is this worth saving? No, I would run. Because when I close my eyes and my heart fills up with love, gender's never a part of it. Gender has never been a part of it. I love my child. Girl, boy, whatever, but I love my child. And if that child were to die, and I knew about the transgender suicide statistics, they were 50%. And if I had to cry at the funeral of my only child, it would hurt just the same whether it was a girl or a boy. And so, you know, what was there is to say, all right, we'll go with that. Alex is the same amazing, witty, wonderful, and loving and generous and kind person. And he is my recovery buddy and holds me to my, you know, holds me to account all the time. And he would, you know, I'd say something and he would be like, Mom, detachment with love. Okay, y'all, this 25-year-old has 16 years in Alateen and Al-Anon. Like, can you imagine having 16 years, like more years in Al-Anon and Alateen than not in Al-Anon and Alateen? Yeah, so, you know, and so the other thing was, when I made amends to my child, I knew that I was not the mom that I wanted to be. And this was an opportunity for me to show up as a mom that was an amend. You know, I got to show up as a mom to this child. At that time, he was in North Carolina. That was not an accepted thing. He was in high school. Oh my God, do you know how much he got bullied? And, you know, people called him it, and how much he got bullied and how much it hurt his feelings. And all of that, I got to be his rock. And he and I got closer. Our relationship was, you know, I would say in this 25-year relationship that he and I have, the first 9 years was pre-Al-Anon. He was scared. I was not a person to be around. I was not a safe person. There was no way that he would come to me for anything, right? Then, between the time that I came to Al-Anon and the time that he came out was a time when it was like, we're kind of sort of adjusting, you're sort of growing into it kind of thing. And then from then on, we're like this. We're close. And you know, the only reason that I get to be a part of my son's life, because you know what, if my son was going to come out, he was going to come out regardless. And if he was going to be, if he was going to transition, he was going to transition regardless. He might have killed himself along the way. But I get to be a part of his life. I get to be his best friend because I got to be a different mom. And that's all I wanted in my step nine, is can I please get a do-over? And I got a do-over. And I got to love him exactly the way he is. Yeah, I know I had these questions of like, what if you change your mind? Right now you're saying he and him. What if you change your mind and now I have to go to she and her? And before that even came out of my mouth, I was like, really, Anu? He's talking about like changing his whole, the way he works and the way he looks and the way he walks and the way he talks. And you're worried that you're going to have to change pronouns. Big deal. And you know, I'm grateful that Alex is not one of those statistics. I'm grateful that I didn't have to attend my child's funeral. And I'm grateful that I have this child in my life, this person in my life who's amazing, who is somebody that's an inspiration for me, and somebody that has me be a better person every single day. That person who's close, that I can talk to about anything. And that person who's going to be showing me my North Star. And he's going to ask me, what is your higher power saying in this? He's going to say, where's your higher power? Have you prayed about it? I'm like, really? Darn it. You know, I'll be complaining about something and it'll be like, what does your higher power say? Have you prayed about it? Did you meditate over it? Seriously. It's, you know, be careful what you ask for. If you want a, you know, recovery buddy, you got to be ready for the recovery buddy to show up. And then tradition 12, anonymity. For me, it was another extension of, you know, step 7, where I felt like one of many. Tradition 12 was, I was at the first international that I went to was in Vancouver. And the big meeting was finished, and then at the end of that big meeting, I ran out. I grew up with, like, you know, running first and being the first one on the escalator and all that kind of stuff. This is how I grew up in India, so I can't take that out of me. So I ran out and I went on the escalator. It was like the world's tallest escalator, I think. And so I'm going up the escalator and I turn around and there's a sea of humanity that's coming out of the rooms. There are people from everywhere, not just little Charlotte, North Carolina, but there are people coming from all over America and Canada and Europe. I mean, I did, you know, I went on a cruise afterwards and I did like Zumba next to this woman from Austria, you know, and there were people from South Africa and all those people that are coming from everywhere. And I get to be a part of that. Tradition 12 is so amazing. Anonymity being the spiritual foundation is so amazing because all of these people are part of Al-Anon. I get to be a part of this worldwide fellowship, y'all. So I've gone on and done a lot of service as well. I'm gonna finish, I promise, in like 2 minutes. I've gone on and done service. I was a group representative, a district representative, and a World Service Delegate for North Carolina, Bermuda. Yes, Bermuda is a part of our area. And And I had the opportunity to know Kay and Maddie in my World Service service. And it was interesting because it was during the pandemic. And so we got to be a part of, like, what does that look like? What does the virtual component look like? And I'm on my last year of service to my area as area chair, which has been a very unique experience. I've learned a lot about humility. I've learned a lot about the concepts and traditions, and I've learned a lot about loving people exactly the way they are. And, you know, it's, my mom was diagnosed with lung cancer in 2019, and she passed away in 2020. And, you know, I got to be of service to her. Instead of holding her as the culprit behind being abandoned, you know, I got to be the daughter I wanted to be. See, I got to be the daughter I wanted to be to my father, and I got to be the daughter I wanted to be to my mother. I mean, I am so blessed. God has given me so many opportunities to be able to do that and to not have regrets. You know, that's the worst thing, is having regrets. So I don't have any regrets. My son came, he graduated in 2020, and he came and helped me. We literally used, like, concepts when we were trying to, like, take care of my mother, because we were, like, stepping over each other's toes trying to take care of her. And my son and I sat down, and he said, "Mom, we should study concept 10 and concept 11. And so we created selected committees. And we decided that we were going to do these different committees, and this was going to be the laundry committee, and this was going to be the cooking committee, and this was going to be the lunch committee. And so we got to take care of my mom, and I was holding my mom's hand when she passed. I mean, what a privilege. What a privilege for somebody who grew up with such a crazy idea of, you know, life and who I was and where I belong. And I just have to tell you, God never gives me any more than I can handle. And one of my favorite lines is a line from the Footprints poem, "It was then that I carried you." Thank you so much for asking me to speak.